We want information. Information. Information.
Who are you?
The new number two.
Who is number one?
You are number six.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
This is chapter 26 of the late Maureen Heaton's 1990 unpublished manuscript entitled The Impossible Dream. I will get to as many chapters after that as I can. We'll try to get up to chapter 30 in this segment. Okay, chapter 26, The Politics of Change. In any production, behind the scenes, or behind the actors seen on stage, there is a crew of hands, the quote-unquote advance man in charge of propaganda, promotion and related matters, the producers, the scriptwriters, the set designers, scenery handlers, costumers, stagehands, electricians, props people, and the ubiquitous backers or angels, i.e., the money people. In the real life drama on the world stage today, parallel positions are known as publicists, consultants, planners, aides, directors, facilitators, change agents, and general all-around quote-unquote experts. And of course, the ubiquitous financiers who may or may not be you and me. Sometimes the curtains part enough to allow a fleeting glimpse of the hidden hands behind the scenes, which prepare the production for public viewing. When this happens, well-trained stagehands quickly close the curtain, and any watchers who note the action and attempt to describe it are given to understand that they didn't really see it because there was nothing really to see. In the real world, this is known as a quote-unquote cover-up. Such was the nature of the exposure of the planning, programming, and budgeting system. Its existence was denied. Its name was changed. Its capability was disguised, and all the rest was silence about it. Such, too, was the policy paper known as The Politics of Change. One of the tactics of the revolutionaries is to respond in silence when they receive a telling blow. It sometimes works against them when they do that. And the matter of this document, The Politics of Change, was one such incident. I had been receiving the output from the California Council on Intergovernmental Relations, CCIR, for some time, when I went before the Governor's Task Force on Local Government Reform to present testimony against the California Council on Intergovernmental Relations and the state meddling in local government affairs. After my appearance there, the Council on Intergovernmental Relations reports stopped coming to my mailbox. I complained to their staff about it, but couldn't get them to reinstate me as a recipient. So I went to my state senator and told him my problem. He called the CIR office and told them I was to be reinstated as a recipient and that I would be over to pick up the documents I hadn't received. When I got there, I was ushered into the office of the person in charge, who apologized profusely for any inconvenience I had suffered, and told the secretary to see that I had whatever documents they had, which I had not received. They were just moving into a big new office, and there were huge boxes of material still not put away. The girl started showing me what was there, going to each box in turn and handing me a copy of its content. I selected those which I had not received. I noticed, though, that there was one box near her desk, which she studiously avoided. When we had finished checking the other boxes, I asked her for a copy of the minutes of the last CIR meeting, and she had to go into another room to get them. While she was gone, I idly picked up one of the documents from the box she had not looked into. It was titled, "The Politics of Change in Local Government Reform," better known now as TPOC. Quote, "Local Government Reform," unquote, was the name of the game at that time, so I added it to my stack. Parentheses. I was supposed to have anything I had not received, and I sure had not received that. End parentheses. So that was one time when they would have been better off if they had just continued sending me the public material. For the Politics of Change, TPOC, was certainly never intended to be seen by the likes of me. It was a textbook on mind control techniques, an appalling negation of the principle of self-government, as it told public servants how to use, quote, "the politics of change," unquote, to obtain programs which the citizens did not want. After I had studied that document, which had come into my hands so fortuitously, I was at a loss as to what to do with it. The first step was suggested by the document itself, because it included three, quote, "case studies," unquote, of situations in California where use of the strategies it provided, quote, "to bring about change in local government structures," unquote, was discussed. Two of those cases were already history, but the third concerned a matter of Sacramento City and County Consolidation, or CCC, where these techniques were then being used to create a single entity, neither city nor county, but a hash of both. She's talking about regionalism, folks. "Now listen up," says Maureen Heaton, "all you who might think I press too hard for election of representatives. It just so happened that there was one representative on the Sacramento City Council, Sandra Smoley, who had been fighting a courageous but lonely battle against consolidation. I did not know her personally, so I arranged for the TPOC, the Politics of Change, document to be taken to her by a mutually trusted ally, and she blew the whistle on the HANDS team using TPOC to reconstruct her city. Thanks to Sandra Smoley, Sacramento City County Consolidated, or CCC, was defeated for that time. Suppose Sandra Smoley had not been elected to that seat on the council. Would there have been a different result? Let's look at another elected official, this one a politician, and sometime mayor of Oakland, California, John C. Houlihan. As mayor of Oakland, Houlihan gave an interview to the Oakland Tribune in 1966, in which he stated that he would be ready to step aside as mayor if, quote, "full-blown government reform," unquote, was implemented statewide. Such reform, he said, would do away with mayors. It would also do away with, quote, cities, counties, districts, and boards of supervisors, unquote. And he predicted that this would come to pass before the turn of the century, possibly by the 1980s. Mr. Houlihan did not have to wait for his prediction to come true to, quote, unquote, step aside. Later in 1966, he was taken to court for looting the estate of an elderly widow, for whom he was conservator. Staunchly maintaining his innocence, he resigned his office under fire. But when he appeared in court, he entered a surprise plea of guilty and was sent to prison. Now the plot thickens. John C. Houlihan was executive director of the Institute for Self-Government at Berkeley in January 1974 when the Politics of Change document, TPOC, was issued. On November 17, 1974, the San Diego Union reported that he had been granted a, quote, full and unconditional pardon, unquote, by then-Governor Reagan for his crime. So apparently, he was out on parole at the time he participated in the production of this document, which was designed to be a tool to build that governmental structure, which he had predicted almost 10 years before. Wow, any of you who think that Reagan was not in on the New World Order scheme, you need to think again. John C. Houlihan is a classic example of a politician as opposed to a representative. The second step I took regarding TPOC was to ask for time at the next meeting of the CIR. Here come the acronyms, folks. Brace yourselves. I hate him too, to challenge the members to repudiate this document, which listed the CIR as sponsor. While waiting to hear from CIR, I took the TPOC document to my county supervisor, and he shared it with the El Dorado Board with the result that they passed a resolution condemning such practices generally and TPOC in particular. That resolution was sent to every person of interest involved at the state level, every county board of supervisors in California, and eventually was reprinted in a number of newsletters and a few local papers, and thus found national distribution. To my knowledge, no other action was ever taken against the strategies recommended in TPOC. In my testimony to CIR, I read portions of that textbook for change, such as the one which called for the use of change agents to manipulate public opinion and to, quote, mislead, coerce, and inhibit the rights of citizens, unquote, to decide what changes they want in their local government. I asked for a response as to whether or not the members of the CIR board were aware that this document was put out in their name, and whether they approved of the use of such tactics. The response was silence. Not one of the 20 or so members spoke up. When the next CCIR meet minutes arrived, they simply said that I had spoken against local government reform. I wrote and demanded a correction of the minutes from the chair, and a minor correction was made, but no mention of the nature of the material I protested was included. I wrote again and repeated my demand for an accurate reflection of my testimony and received a non-committal reply. I then wrote to my state senator, no reply. I then wrote to then-Governor Reagan and sent him a copy of my testimony, copies of the letters mentioned above, and requested action from him. No reply. Silence. It is of interest to note that when a citizen wrote to the Institute in Berkeley for a copy of TPOC, The response was that that report had been compiled at the request of the California Council on Criminal Justice and was not published, but had been sent to the successor agency, the Office of Criminal Justice Planning. The citizen was told it would cost $8 to reproduce the manuscript and mail it. Now, there are two interesting things about that. One, in the foreword to TPOC, it states that it was compiled under a contract with the Office of Intergovernment Management in coordination with CCIR and the Governor's Office. Make of that what you will. And then there is two. The box which contained the TPOC documents was in the CIR office, not the OCJP. The container was humongous, and it was half full, or half empty, if you like. Make of that what you will. It is important for all citizens to know that California's TPOC is not an isolated instance. There are think tanks all over the country applying themselves to mass behavior modification techniques such as this. And the evidence of the use of such strategies is increasing. It is simply amazing that so little notice has been taken of what these would-be manipulators are doing. Uncovering TPOC was a pure and simple happenstance, but thousands of change agents are being prepared in our institutions of higher education to continue developing this psy war technique, and that is no accident. Why do you suppose none of those being trained to control their fellow man protest? Why no recognition of the dangers inherent in change agentry, which has become an integral part of government action, with elected officials attending seminars at public expense to learn how to get their constituents to accept programs neither wanted or needed? Chapter 27, The Wretched Refuse. Emma Lazarus was born in New York of Sephardic Jewish parents. Early in life, she fell away from the faith of her fathers and displayed no interest in religion for the rest of her days. When the Soviet pogroms began and found an echo in the streets of New York, Lazarus took up the cause and became a radical militant. She was advocating a national Jewish state in Palestine 10 years before the modern Zionist movement began. It was at this time that she authored The New Colossus for the cause which brought the Statue of Liberty to New York Harbor. Save for one short passage referring to quote-unquote slave trade, the United States Constitution was silent on the matter of immigration, properly leaving this issue to Congress to work their will, as need might require. For many years, free immigration was encouraged, and the United States was the debtor to men and women of courage who sought the rewards promised to good citizens under its government. By mid-19th century, the radical movements on the continent began to metastasize, and American liberty became a magnet for those alien ideologies. While some natives here, like Lazarus, abused their privileges, nothing could be done about that under the First Amendment. The radical influx from abroad, however, was open to intervention, which was not long in coming. With Lazarus's plea to quote-unquote send more of the huddled masses through the quote-unquote golden door, a new dimension was needed for policy on immigration, and the quota system was devised to limit the waves of homeless, feckless foreigners. Health examinations were now required, and standards had to be met for entrance. A quote-unquote sponsor had to guarantee that the immigrant would not become a public charge. From the beginning, immigration laws were a center of controversy, which mounted in intensity as the beginnings of organization for one peaceful world became reality. around the turn of the 20th century. The engagement known as quote-unquote World War I provided the staging ground for the first massive rearrangement of the world map. Colonel House was ready with his extended group of social scientists to allot territory, devise governments, and provide human resources to begin the reconstruction. Concurrently, the establishment created ex officio groups here and in England to penetrate both governments with the intent of directing quote-unquote foreign policy. The American group, so-called, on the Council on Foreign Relations was the American group, it lost no time in beginning the work of the master puppeteers in preparation for allotting territory, devising alternative government forms, breaking down boundaries, giving the new states new identities, dividing the spoils of the war, quote-unquote, more equitably, and providing the human resources necessary to implement this part of the plan. Breakdown of national boundaries was not intended to exclude the United States. So, when the Federal Council of Churches met at their historic gathering in Ohio in 1932 to issue their call for world government, among the ultimata the delegates were suborned into accepting was a call for, quote, worldwide freedom of immigration, unquote. As Patriot Frank Kirkpatrick put it in discussing that conclave on his radio program more than 40 years ago, quote, what it means is that there would be no limitation on who could come to America and take over this country. In other words, the only limitation would be the number of ships available to bring the teeming hordes of other continents to this USA, unquote. The clamor to void the restrictions on immigration became even more strident after World War II. With Korea behind us, the call became louder and ever more insistent. Servicemen who had become involved with foreign nationals bedeviled their congressmen for special dispensations. Back in the 50s, several quote-unquote unthinkable concepts emerged as peripheral adjuncts to the NIEO plan, the NWO plan. These concepts were so quote-unquote far out, it wasn't possible to include them in logical arguments about the plan back then. Some of these quote-unquote far-out schemes are being advanced so openly now that they have become routine in our daily lives. So it is with the issue of, quote, immigration reform, unquote. That portion of the 1982 Immigration Reform Act, which proposed, quote, universal employment verification, unquote. Yep, there it is. However, that was one of the unthinkable schemes, which surfaced more than 30 years ago and only now is being brought stage, front, and center. A, quote, universal identification card, unquote, or UIC, just as proposed in that act, is a natural adjunct to the control system which is now in operation. While the early intimation of a UIC was not connected with immigration, it is interesting to note that the pressures to, quote-unquote, liberalize United States policy on immigration began to mount at about the same time that controls on employment were first suggested. In 1963, John Kennedy called for revision of the immigration laws. Upon his death, and in tribute to him, Congress responded with a spate of bills which culminated in an emasculated protection from foreign invasion through immigration. Even the inadequate controls which remained are now honored in the breach. Under the McCarran/Walter Act of 1952, the qualitative controls of quota and national origin were extended but not completely neutered. It took the Kennedy/Johnson/Hart/Seller bill in 1963 to do that. Opening the door on the troubles which will result from this, quote, job verification system, unquote. There is a crying need for Congress to re-examine U.S. policy on immigration, but to tie the problems now involved in the, quote, unquote, open border policies, which have become a mounting threat to our national identity, by the way, and to tie that to a requirement for citizens to have government authorization as a prerequisite for work or even existence is an ominous step. Surprisingly, it was Senator Alan Simpson, Republican Wyoming, who blew the whistle on the Public Works and Economic Development Act of 1979. Yet, in 1982, he was identified as author and legislative whip for the Immigration Reform Act. It was a shock to learn that he intended to, quote, plow right ahead with immigration reform, unquote, despite the, quote, hue and cry churning up in some quarters. Since all the other provisions of the bill together did not generate the concerns the section on universal ID did, it seems clear that quote-unquote immigration reform was not the issue. It was that element, the universal identification card, which was. This element should not even be debatable because it is not within the powers and duties of Congress under the Constitution to legislate on such a matter. If it were, it would still be controversial, for it impinges on the rights and privileges every American is endowed with at birth. It is the duty and the responsibility of Congress to protect the rights and privileges of native-born citizens. It is the responsibility of Congress to recognize that citizenship in this country is a privilege for those of foreign birth and not an alien right, quote unquote. It is Congress's duty to protect the national integrity through discreet selection of those permitted entry. America welcomed the refugees from Castro's Cuba, but there was more than the issue of sanctuary even there. The quote unquote Bracero program for Mexicans was reneged on by Congress, resulting in the quote-unquote illegals swarming across the border. Foreign exchange students swelled the flood, bringing alien ideas right into the American home. Pressures for quote-unquote adopting foreign children by proxy escalated into outright adoptions by non-ethnics. Then the tragic end to the Vietnamese nightmare and the quote-unquote boat people. A new, stronger prospect of an unending stream from Latin and South American revolutions increases the threat from that quarter. And now the China quote-unquote revolt holds additional possibilities of hordes of refugees, in addition to Chinese nationals holding temporary visas here, seeking asylum. And all the while, Native Americans are encouraged to limit their families, abort their unborn children, and welcome these huddled masses in their place. Pause right there. If you listen to my prior archives, GordonComstock.com, go to the audio page, which is probably where you found this. Go and listen to the books which I've already read by Samuel Morse, the renowned American inventor. In the early 1800s, he was warning about the same things, the same dangers of foreign immigration. And not only that, he tells you what Maureen Heaton doesn't know, because what he knew back then has been buried, unconscionably, fantastically buried in history. But Samuel Morse, if you listen to that, he'll tell you who's at the top of the pyramid sending these immigration, illegal immigrants here. And behind all the propaganda for moronic Americans to welcome them without any prerequisite, without anything. It's the deliberate destruction of this country. And Samuel Morse's books, the first one, well, I read both of them. I don't know what order, but it was Imminent Dangers to the United States and Foreign Conspiracy. Okay, back to the book, back to Maureen Heaton. Under the circumstances, it would be less than human not to empathize with these unfortunate pawns, but one would have to be more than mortal not to resent and resist the threat they hold to continuance of the American dream. Even the Federal Council of Churches didn't ask the United States to adopt freedom of immigration unilaterally. It has taken muddle-headed liberals in Congress to lead the way to a modern-day Tower of Babel here, despite the absence of acceptance of such a patent idiocy by other countries. So this is no accident, folks. This is deliberate. That's me talking. Back to Maureen. If there are any statesmen in Congress today, the question of quote-unquote immigration will be brought up again and addressed on its demerits. If there is none bold enough to buck this current now, that can be remedied at the polls. It says in a rather optimistic Maureen Heaton. Chapter 28, The Panama Affair. Arguably, the most important act of the Carter administration was the agreement it made about Panama. In time, the decision made then assumed an even greater import than was apparent in 1977. Although many facts which were presented in opposition to the administration's proposed abrogation of the historic relations between Panama and the U.S. were not considered germane to the decision made then, events have justified the widespread concerns expressed at the time. In reviewing the steps leading to the signing away of the American presence in Panama, it is evident that matters directly affecting the action taken were calculatedly pushed aside. Perhaps the most important such matter was the deliberate denial by the Carter administration of the quote-unquote democratic ideals it so piously proclaimed. Not only was the quote-unquote treaty not in response to the desires of either the American people or those who lived in the Canal Zone, but poll after poll showed that 70% to 90% of Americans opposed abrogating the original agreement on Panama. Of prime importance, too, and not taken into account, was the revelation in the official Soviet military organ, Red Star, in June of 77, which identified the Canal Zone as a quote-unquote priority territory marked for Soviet conquest. Continuing the historic Soviet pattern of international subversion, breaking the ties between Panama and America not only gave greater opportunity for a Marxist takeover there, it left the territory at the mercy of the likes of Noriega. In the Soviet blueprint for global conquest, Panama has always been an essential element in the Lenin-planned encirclement of the United States, which, combined with internal subversion, would, quote, eliminate the need for armed aggression, unquote. America would fall into the Soviet orbit, quote, like a ripe fruit, unquote. The quote-unquote laundering of political funds, which the mass media takes delight in exposing, is small potatoes compared with the quote-unquote laundering of reputations long since stained by their possessors. One such reputation, which received a cleansing in the mid-70s, had a direct relation to the Panama situation. It belonged to Alger Hiss. Treated by the media as a long overdue correction of a monstrous injustice, the Hiss restatement echoed the quote-unquote responsibility being bestowed on the Soviet Union through détente, glasnost, and perestroika. It was of some immediate import because it was followed in short order by the debates over Panama. Among Alger Hiss's deeds was one monstrous betrayal, which laid the foundation for the canal problem. That betrayal is, and was then, a non-issue to the press. But it was a vital element in U.S. history. The Hiss Chambers confrontation has had extensive coverage in books and articles, but to find the key to the Panama problem, musty government records must be sought and studied. A difficult job. So, for the record, here is a brief summary. Having realized unimagined advantages as a result of World War II, the Soviets had stepped up their subversive activities worldwide, never losing sight, however, of their designated prime target, the United States. Penetration of Mexico was ongoing, and agitation in Latin America was insistent over the years. Success in Cuba was an invaluable victory. But Panama held a high priority in the Soviet scheme for world conquest. The strategic Soviet thrust at Panama had been to challenge the right of the United States to have a presence there. Basic to validating that right are the provisions of the 1903 treaty. In 1946, the newly formed United Nations conducted a survey of the nations of the world preliminary to beginning to function under its charter. The Republic of Panama presented its official statement to the UN authority, including the facts about U.S. involvement there. That statement has never been challenged except by the communists, and that unofficially. The Panama delegation reported, quote, "The strip of land known as the Panama Canal Zone has been neither purchased, conquered, annexed, ceded, nor leased. Nor has its sovereignty been transferred to the United States. There is no native population. There is no permanent population. The land is solely inhabited by officials, employees, and workers of the Panama Canal, and by the families of these. They live in the zone while they are working for the canal. When a person has stopped working for the canal, he must depart from the zone. In consequence, the population of that territory changes constantly. It has no interest there, nor political aspirations for independence," unquote. Quote-unquote self-government is the critical issue. It was under Article 73 of the UN Charter that Alger Hiss placed the zone in jeopardy and laid the groundwork for the turmoil over Panama today. Article 73E calls on UN member states who, quote, "have or assume responsibilities for territories whose people have not yet attained a full measure of self-government," unquote, to make regular reports to the Secretary of General. quote-unquote, not yet, is the operative phrase. In his position as an Under Secretary of State for Political Affairs, but without authority or even the knowledge of his superiors, Alger Hiss secretly prepared and delivered to the UN Secretariat a paper which placed the United States' relationship with the Canal Zone as one of trust, awaiting the time for, quote, a full measure of self-government, unquote. Officials at State, learning of this paper, tried frantically to divert delivery, but the perpetrator of the fraud was nowhere to be found, and no one else knew how the paper was being delivered. The damage was done, and by this means, Panama was identified for the record as being denied free political exercise by the United States. Spruill Braden, who was the secretary in charge of Latin American affairs in the State Department at that time, testified to the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee about the Hiss action. He pointed out that, so far as the Republic of Panama was concerned, the zone was, and had been since 1903, quote-unquote, self-governing, and that Hiss had not only exceeded his authority by making that report to the UN without approval of his superiors, but had, quote, opened a Pandora's box of troubles, unquote, for the United States. The Hiss submission to the UN caused a furor in Washington. Most of officialdom first learned of it by reading the Washington Post. As a result of that one act, by a man who was officially found to be, quote, an underground agent of the USSR, unquote, the friendly Panamanians were outraged. A number of other Latin American nations were alienated. The Soviets received confirmation from a high-ranking American official that their contention about American imperialism was true. And, most importantly, the UN received a valid claim to a stake in the operations of the canal. That is why there is trouble in Panama today. It could have been Alger Hiss that Joe McCarthy had in mind when he told that audience in Wheeling, Virginia, quote, we are not just dealing with spies who get 30 pieces of silver for stealing blueprints. We are dealing with a far more sinister activity because it permits the enemy to guide and shape our policy, unquote. Communist agitation in Panama has accelerated with increasing success until the Soviet objective there was granted sanction by the man in the highest office of the U.S. of A. A Pandora's box indeed. The inroads made by the Soviets in government all over the world are perceivably greater today. The deepening red hue in the Caribbean, increased activity in Mexico and other Central American states, and problems in Nicaragua and El Salvador. In view of these facts, the insistence of the Carter State Department and the White House on the new quote-unquote treaty spelled disaster. The quote-unquote new treaty with Panama realigned our position there into the old communist blueprint. But the question of whether or not the document brought back from Panama by, quote-unquote, our negotiator is a treaty at all should be examined. Saul Linowitz, named by the resident of the White House to act for the United States in the Panama situation, was not confirmed in that capacity by the Senate, as required by the Constitution. So he was without portfolio, and therefore without authority. possibly because there was concern lest the Senate actually reject the appointment. Due to the adverse nature of the information available about Linowitz, the so-called negotiations were carried on with undue haste. In a seeming effort to get the job done before the Damascus sword of Senate disapproval fell, that haste raised legitimate concern. The public was continually being soothed with the promise of a long-range target date, such as the year 2000, comfortably distant from 1977, but factually irrelevant to the whole situation. The paper, which was signed on the 7th of September, 1977, with all pomp and ceremony, if anything, was no more than an agreement on general principles made by those promoting it, and none other. A peculiar question of international law was raised because of the Carter administration action. There was no country of Panama in 1903. At that time, Panama was a city in Colombia, and despite some obscure machinations, the treaty was made with the Republic of Colombia. How then can that country be bypassed in any renegotiation? A treaty, to all intent and purpose, is an equivalent of law, and a law can only be modified by the same body which created it. Another vital fact, which has been deliberately obfuscated, is that there most definitely is a communist conspiracy for world conquest. From World War I until the mid-1960s, United States security agencies were continuously engaged in documenting that conspiracy, its strategies, tactics, and personnel. It is passing strange how the news media, so fiercely righteous in opposition to quote-unquote right-wing governments, finds quote-unquote left-wing militant coups completely acceptable. Thus, the news hounds choked on the quote-unquote right-wing Chilean revolt, but easily swallowed the Marxist takeover in Panama, and actively promoted cooperation with that illegal regime. Instead of playing God with the future of this great globe by voting to approve the Carter Initiative for Panama, the United States Senate should have been preparing American citizens to cope with the problems caused by the executive action which set up Panama for the trouble there today. Chapter 29, Goals for Americans. A committee of Congress once published a report on the communist use of language as a subversive weapon. Today, practically everything published by government, by the media, and general information in books, magazines, on radio and TV may fall into a quote-unquote subversive weapon category. Should be viewed as suspect and examined with a questioning mind. This is equally true of much of the so-called conservative literature. The first question, parentheses, which should be constantly asked of oneself on every issue or situation, end parentheses, is, what purpose is being served? Only when the true purpose has been determined can one safely relax the vigil and accept that purpose as a guide to evaluating the message. It is a constant source of amazement to find how thoroughly language can be perverted, so that it seems to be saying one thing, but actually is giving a deliberately false impression. As regards some of the apparently conservative material, there are additional problems. The language may clearly and correctly state the case, but suggested action sometimes is diversionary, sometimes supports the Hegelian predetermined solution. Increasingly, books and pamphlets are appearing which purport to be conservative, but stem from either the so-called quote-unquote new right, or even quote-unquote new age, which have a demonstrable divergence from the general output of traditional conservative writing. One of the most flagrant examples of the use of language as a subversive technique exists in the bills which were passed in California to introduce the management and control system into government departments. Those bills were a classic in this technique. Even when one became aware that those bills created the permission for the system, it took careful examination to determine how they did that. Only one legislator in California apparently saw the true purpose of those bills, and he only voted against one of them. Of course, others might have known. One might could have been the author, but that doesn't necessarily follow. So carefully were those bills worded to mislead that it is easy to understand that even the legislator who submitted them might not have known what they really would do. They might have been slip bills prepared in one of the numerous incubators of the Rockefeller 1313 conglomerate. We do know that those bills were sent to the legislature by the governor's office, and the legislative author was simply the conduit to drop them in the hopper. When we began to try to trace the development of that management system, one of the first offices we approached for information was that of the committee created by the California legislature to develop the system. As we waited for someone to come out and discuss the planning, programming, and budgeting system with us, we noted a small bookshelf beside the front desk with a dozen or so books neatly arranged on top of it. Being a bookworm, it was almost involuntary for me to wander over and examine them. Several had unfamiliar terminology in their titles, but one was quickly recognized as a book which had puzzled me 10 years earlier. It was called, quote, Goals for Americans, unquote, and subtitled The Report of the President's Commission on National Goals. I found myself wondering why that report of so long ago was of interest in an office in which a modern management system was being developed. I remembered when I first read that report on national goals, the impression it left with me was that the Commission on Goals was apparently another boondoggle, parentheses, which was what exercises in bureaucracy used to be called, into parentheses. Much sound and fury and little significance. I could not understand why thousands of copies of pamphlets which gave a synopsis of the report were distributed gratis, when it was published in paperback at nominal cost, which anyone interested could afford. Seeing it now, here in that office, prompted me to dig out my copy when I got home and read it again. This time I understood. This little book is a consummate example of the use of language to deceive the electorate and those they elect. When Dwight David Eisenhower appointed the President's Commission on National Goals, he chose establishment people to man the panel. Of the 11 members, 7 were also members of the elitist Council on Foreign Relations. 2 were university professors. 1 was president of the AFL-CIO. and the last was a retired judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals. Wow, all the usual suspects. The commission was privately funded, which effectively denied congressional oversight. The presence of those establishment persons assured control of any goals they might determine. Should you doubt the ability of such a commission to develop a set of goals supportive of elitist programs, which would have a prayer of being implemented, the source of the commission's funding should leave no doubt. Credit is given in the preface of the report to the the Carnegie, Ford, Rockefeller, and Sloan foundations, among others. All of the usual devilish suspects. If that isn't enough to demonstrate something more than bureaucratic fun and games, the whole effort was produced under the auspices of the American Assembly, another establishment front. But you see, when I first read this report, circa 1960, I didn't know these things were important. Neither did I know that this was a strategy which had been successfully used in 1930 to produce Herbert Hoover's report on recent social trends, which was prelude to the planned society. So I had no foundation for believing that, quote, goals for Americans, unquote, was the prelude to another phase of the revolution. And I dismissed it, as I do believe most who read it then did, with no inkling of its potential. Unlike me, few people are likely to have had an experience such as this, which caused them to study it again, later, when events had given it import, which was not visible at first reading. The report opens with an introduction which appears to be a ringing salute to, quote, the paramount goal of the United States, unquote, as that goal was set by the founding fathers. Interlaced in the praise was an implication that that goal was also the goal of the commission, but with a difference. For, as they expounded on that original goal, these latter-day founding fathers included the concept that government is responsible for ensuring the welfare of the citizens, their development, and their opportunities. Sounds like communism to me. The commission also presumed to enlarge the original goal of this nation to, quote, an even broader and bolder declaration than those who created that goal knew, unquote. That, quote-unquote, expansion of the original goal is the basis for many of the interventions causing so much trouble today, including the control system. In that introduction to these new goals, this group of elitists also stated that the legal government of this nation rests on two, quote-unquote, fundamental principles: election of representatives and constitutional limitation of power of those elected. While many Americans might well accept those two, quote-unquote, principles as valid, the truth is that neither of these were goals as put forth in the Declaration of Independence, nor are they major thrusts of the Constitution. Separation of powers of government, limitation of power of the central government, those were the major goals expressed. The first in the Constitution itself, and the second in the Bill of Rights. The introduction of the report also states that, quote, the way to preserve freedom is to live it, unquote, a questionable premise, but easily accepted if there is no reason for doubting what is being said. But the commission leaps from that to reveal that their aim is to, quote, build a new nation and help build a world, unquote. And that is what these new goals were designed to do, as the record shows. Were it not for the fact that these goals have been diligently promoted ever since they were announced in this report, it would be of little value to discuss them now. But they have been insistently pursued, so it is vital today to know what they are. Not knowing about these new goals is the basic reason why Americans have difficulty making sense, quote unquote, out of the programs being implemented today. Goal number one is of paramount importance, for in it is revealed the main thrust of the rest of the goals. Goal number one is aimed at the takeover by government of every facet of the citizen's life. Government is to enhance the citizen's dignity, promote maximum development of the citizen's capabilities, stimulate his personal development, and provide opportunities for its use. Goal number two is to eliminate discrimination. Goal number three is to, quote, preserve and protect democracy, unquote. Goal number four is for total involvement of education in building that, quote unquote, new world. New techniques and strategies in teaching, more federal funds to facilitate these changes, provision of a standard, quote-unquote, norm. Goal number five is to, quote-unquote, realize full understanding of the world, high priority for, quote-unquote, arts and sciences, with increased federal funding for both, initiation of, quote, manpower development reform, unquote, and finally, of all things, reform of television performance. Parentheses, just look at the changes in TV since 1960. Was this what was meant by quote-unquote reform? End parentheses. Boy, Maureen, you have a point there. Yeah, I could easily see that. Television has become horrendously debauched since the early 1960s. Yeah, I suppose that probably was part of their goal. Goal number six is to provide government participation in the economy, known today as, quote-unquote, privatization. Goal number seven is an open call for government management of the economy. Wow. That's scary. Goal number eight calls for, quote, technological change, unquote. Goal number nine calls for interventions in agriculture to avoid shock to the economy. This goal should be approached in gradual stages, unquote. Even then, it is shocking, writes Maureen Heaton, as any farmer could testify today, and specifically farmers Call and Kirk, who were killed in trying to resist, end parentheses. Goal number 10 addresses, quote-unquote, living conditions, land use planning, urban renewal, containing urban sprawl, withholding federal, quote-unquote, aid to resistant areas. Goal number 11 specifies programs for health and welfare, quote, identify problems in order that government may formulate wiser policies of regulation. There you go. End quote. Number 11 is the key to it all. Regulation and the consequent need for management and control, as acknowledged in goal number 7. Having reread this report, I found it perfectly clear why it was on the desk in the office of the committee directed by the California legislature to develop the control system for that state. Before anybody cries foul and charges this is out of context, let it proudly be admitted that it is indeed out of context. It is only by taking a nut out of the shell that the meat is digestible. It is only by taking the meat out of these quote-unquote goals, taking them out of context, that they can be viewed by the average person in their essential nature. I know. I read this once as your average American, and all I saw was nuts. Read again with knowledge of ensuing events. The true nature of these goals is no longer obscure anymore. Simply reading this deliberately obfuscated program of goals as prepared for public consumption would not make the case against them. Remember, they were prepared by experts to produce public acceptance of new goals for America, disguised as simply extension of the original goal. How much this little book has had the intended effect cannot be determined, but public resistance to these un-American concepts is at a low ebb. The whole document was written to obtain support from the grassroots, and it now seems to have been achieved. To be against such sweet-sounding goals as these are made to seem in the context of this report would be in the realm of rejecting apple pie and motherhood, or at least being against progress. As for foul, if all's fair in love and war, and politics, remember, is another form of war, then foul is a non sequitur. If it is foul to expose wrongdoing, so be it. There is no legal justification for what is being done in this program by these matoids. They fatten at the public trough while their intended victims go broke, trying to defend their heritage and themselves directly against this abuse of power. These who deliberately and fraudulently conceal their true purpose and goal are worse than prostitutes peddling their illicit trade to consenting adults who see only the surface favors and do not know, or who sublimate their knowledge, that they are risking everything worthwhile for momentary gratification. This is not, quote, momentary gratification, unquote. This program is meant to be total and forever. Evil men have always attempted to perform evil deeds. It has been so since the world began. Because it is still so, the debauching of America is proceeding without let. Those who should be on guard are not, and there is no one to raid the premises where such deeds are schemed and planned. All right, I'm not a big fan of that last sentence. Chapter 30, the Supreme Court as an agent of change. When the Constitution of the United States was hammered out that hot summer in Philadelphia, every effort was made to avoid the pitfalls which history had shown led to untimely ends for other governments. Having experienced tyranny, the settlers here were determined to prevent once and for all the forging of shackles for the citizens such as tyrants had ever devised for subjects. Instead, our forebears placed the shackles on the government. Well, Maureen, oh gosh. If Maureen was here now and had read the stuff that I've read that's on againstthegrainpress.com, atgpress.com, I think she would change her mind on this. Just, I think. Shackles on the government, leaving the citizens in control of the ship of state. Don't we all wish? The Supreme Court was created to be a bulwark against usurpation and to ensure that the government provided would be continued under law, or, if altered, that too would be by law. The Supreme Court was delegated the responsibility of guarding the general liberties of the people by being given the authority to examine any and all acts which might not be consonant with the intent of the Constitution. During the time when it performed in the manner intended, the Supreme Court served its purpose, and these United States grew and prospered, and the citizenry did likewise. The fabled opportunities which existed in this quote-unquote land of plenty were the direct result of an inspired government monitored by an honorable court, following tried and proven procedures and precedents. Man, I can almost not read this anymore without getting sick. Any time I read laudatory things about the Constitution and the so-called Founding Fathers, I know better now. I so used to be a constitutionalist and revere the Founding Fathers. I know better now, though. All right, back to Maureen. Through the ages, though, there had been this elitist dream to play God and direct the destinies of all mankind. The Founding Fathers were well aware of this tendency by some men to want dominion over their fellows. Yeah, I'll bet they were. Sure they were. They were part of it. And specifically recognized it by attempting to build effective restraints against any usurpation of power. But they could not envision a time when conniving men would possess the ultimate power attainable in this world. I don't know about that. A means of directing the mental processes of mankind. How could they guard against something which neither existed at the time, nor could possibly have been foreseen? During the last century, an assortment of elitist groups emerged, each holding a variant of the quote-unquote impossible dream as an unholy grail. Each drew recruits from amongst their own strata of society and from the dregs of humanity. But the great middle sector of mankind was not drawn to misty dreams, especially in the U.S. Opportunity unlimited, that was the American dream. Deeply religious, most Americans knew that utopia was not of this world. The Bible told them so. Yeah, it sure did, unless you're an idiot dominionist today. Religion was the greatest obstacle to the elitist dream, and the revolutionaries have clearly recognized that fact. The churches became the primary objective for their machinations. Infiltration there began a long time ago and has never ceased. Karl Prussian told of the communist plan to send him into the ministry to carry out his subversion there. He was taken to the head of the largest seminary in the United States, and of him Prussian said, "I shook his hand and called him comrade," quote-unquote. Internal agents, such as that, were abetted by external attacks, creating a pincer movement against organized religion with devastating effect on all faiths. Once mastery of control of men's minds by scientific methods was assured, all politico-socio-economic avenues leading to realization of that ages-old dream became targeted. Political structures, education, and all related matters. Transportation and the rest followed in such swift forays that determination of their succession is difficult to ascertain. But somewhere along the way, the Supreme Court was drawn into orbit and began to take its place as an agent of national dissolution. Probably nothing the court has done brings their role into focus more clearly than the infamous, quote, separation of church and state, unquote, decision, which laid the ground for all related later cases. That decision involved a case where a local school board had encouraged children to say a grace before snacking at school. The Supreme Court, responding to a challenge, finally determined that this violated the First Amendment, thus setting a precedent which has circumscribed all religious practices which in any way impinge government involvement. That the court did not base that decision on the fact is implicit in the First Amendment itself, which they cited. The First Amendment clearly and concisely states that, quote, Congress, not a local school board, shall make no law respecting the establishment of a religion. Freedom of religious practice was the lodestar which brought the pilgrims to these shores, and it was the keystone of our government, so that they would be free to worship as they chose without a government-established religion. This vital issue was settled for all time, so they hoped, by the First Amendment. The next clause in the First Amendment confirms that by providing that there are no, quote, prohibiting the free exercise, unquote, of religion, a local school board, acting as the agent of the parents of their wards, was not, quote, establishing a religion, unquote, with that prayer. They were allowing the free exercise of worship. In their holding, in this case, the court violated the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, and the First itself. This precedent-setting case, therefore, found the Supreme Court clearly rejecting their constitutional role of guardian of the people's liberties, and assuming the role of agent of change, opening a floodgate of attacks on the people's right to practice whatever religion they adhere to in whatever manner they choose. Okay, that's the end of chapter 30, and this has been the reading, a reading of from Maureen Heaton's, the late Maureen Heaton's 1990 unpublished manuscript entitled The Impossible Dream, predicting, warning of the new feudalism, the new dark ages, which is coming upon the world now in the form of the New World Order. And you can call it a lot of other things than that. Again, I read these things because you're never going to find these audiobooks, an audiobook like this, in the library, in a public library. Are you kidding? No way. So, for that, it's valuable. I get to read it, and if you guys are into audiobooks, you get to listen to it also. So, good for both of us. All right, well, thank you guys. God bless. Keep the faith. And if you haven't got the faith in Jesus Christ, get down on your knees and get it. Repent of your sins and confess that you need Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior. Because there's not a lot of time. Well, your life hasn't got a lot of time. None of us have a lot of time. But it may be even that this world doesn't have a lot of time if Cassandra's like Maureen Heaton are right. Thanks for listening. This has been the Ministry of Truth with Gordon Comstock at gordoncomstock.com. Bye-bye.
If I told you now, if I told you now, if I told you now, hallelujah. If I told you now, I leave my children here. If I told you now, I would have you.
This world is not my home. This world is not my home. This world is not my home. Pass you. This world is not my home. This world is not my home. This world is not my home. I'm just passing through. I can't live at home in this world anymore. I can't live at home in this world anymore. I can't live at home in this world anymore. I can't live at home in this world anymore.
This world That is the way things are.